This is your World War III breaking news update. I got to make this quick. Oh boy, I told you guys 2 days ago that they were getting ready to nuke Iran. In fact, I think I even used something like this that you're seeing behind me here in the thumbnail, and I can't believe they're actually going to do it. I'm still in disbelief because here we are. They're getting ready to pull the trigger. Your world is about to change. Now, we have confirmation that a half dozen, possibly seven, of the 20 B-2 stealth bomber fleet is being forward deployed. I repeat, a half dozen stealth bombers being forward deployed to Diego Garcia Air Base, which is south of the Maldives in the Indian Ocean. This is one of two very critical U.S. air bases in the Indo-Pacific. And that, of course, is going to put Yemen and Iran in striking distance. Now, I highly doubt you would need such a massive force for Yemen, especially considering you have all of these aircraft carriers headed to Yemen as we speak. I think there's going to be four in total if you add up all of the aircraft carriers of the coalitional forces. So they're getting ready for something major, guys. Now, in order to do Iran, you either need tactical nuclear weapons or you need massive ordnance penetrator bombs that can only be deployed on these big bombers, all right? And you're probably going to need a lot of them, which is why they're amassing so much force. Iran presumably has something the equivalent of an S-400 with good radars that could potentially definitely detect, the U.S.'s normal bombers, maybe even detect a stealth bomber. Who knows? If they can shoot down a stealth bomber, that's going to be a game changer if they can do it. If they can see it, they can shoot it down. They have the means of shooting it down. I mean, the Houthis are shooting down drones operating at 50,000 feet. There's no reason why the Iranians couldn't shoot down a bomber if they can have the radars that can actually see it. Maybe they do. We're not going to know until it actually goes down. But never before have the stars been aligned for the neocons in such a way to do Iran, and they probably never will be for years, decades, if ever again, in the way that they are right now. You have the most pro-Israeli government in history, I would argue, currently in the White House, which is crazy considering what has just happened in the last year. Oil is relatively low, okay, and the strategic oil reserve is full enough that if Trump needed to take some of the pressure off the system, he could open up the spigot and he could do it under the justification that they're going to drill, baby, drill, and don't worry, we're going to fill it back up again. You have the proxy network, which has been decimated from Syria to Iraq to Gaza, the West Bank, Lebanon, Yemen, all of which have been systematically destroyed. Yemen is really the final domino to fall before they go into Iran. In fact, it's going to be the bridge. It is going to be the vector through which they can enter into Iran, because what's likely going to happen, and I think this is the only thing that's missing, they have everything. They have the tacit support of MAGA, who for the most part is either going to be oblivious to a war in Iran, they're going to be indifferent, many will actually support it, not all, but many. I think you're going to have some libertarian, non-interventionist purists who are going to rail against the idea, but, you know, they'll be placated by whatever type of domestic fiasco unfolds. And in the very least, what they can do is throw out or hope for some more Disneyland race-baiting fiasco, culture war dealio, possibly, you know, sprinkle some Epstein files in there and JFK and drones and Fort Knox, and they'll be able to distract people. There never has been a better time for them to attack Iran, and you can bet that they're going to seize on this opportunity. So I suspect that in the coming weeks, months at the latest, we're going to see a major operation against Iran. Now, there's a lot of geopolitical context here. There's some interplay between what's going on in Russia and Ukraine and what is going on here. I have some technical data and the rationale for this hypothesis to present to you today, because I'm not a military aviational expert. I only pretend to be. So I'm going to rattle off the data just so you have all of the data that you need to make an informed opinion about all this. But all I can say is that you need to prepare. Okay, you absolutely need to prepare because things could go off the rails really, really fast. And it cannot be understated the extent to which this is abnormal to have such a large forced posture. And all of these stealth bombers will be accompanied with those 18 aerial refueling tankers that are going to be at their disposal. So this is big, and this could just be the beginning of a buildup. Now, Trump issued Iran an ultimatum the other day. He said, you have a couple months to comply and basically renounce your non-commitment to getting nuclear weapons, because, of course, the Iranians have never stated they wanted nuclear weapons, although they have stated that they are a latent nuclear state in the sense that they're a threshold nuclear state, in the sense that they could make a nuclear weapon arguably within weeks, possibly days. In fact, I've seen some Iranian pundits say that they can do it within a day if they wanted to, that they have all the components. So Trump made them an ultimatum saying you have 2 weeks to comply. Now, the Iranians are never going to dismantle their nuclear program. And of course, because of the history with the Soleimani assassination, they know that this means war, which is why today they released yet another video of this massive labyrinthine subterranean complex that appears to be home to hundreds, if not thousands, of intermediate range, long range, short range, ship, anti-ship missiles, ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, you name it, bombs galore in these massive complexes. Iran is prepared for World War III. Okay, I mean, look at this. This is absolutely crazy considering they have dozens of these facilities, and this is where in the same type of facility that their nuclear centrifuges are going to be buried. The only way you can do that, the only way you're going to put a dent in any of that is by utilizing either tactical nuclear weapons or these massive ordnance penetrators, and lots of them. And the last I heard, I don't think they have a lot of those at their disposal. The U.S. Air Force, I think, don't quote me on this, but I think they had like 20 or something, 20 operational MOAB-type bombs. And of course, you need a big, big bomber in order to carry those things, so you need a stealth bomber. If they can shoot down a stealth bomber, it's a game-changing situation, okay? Because you're putting them up against a near peer, possibly an S-400. Well, the Russians have allegedly tipped off the Iranians that an American attack is coming, okay? Now, this is unconfirmed. This is through the Telegram grapevine, just the part about the Russian intelligence sharing with the Iranians. So take that one with a grain of salt, but I would not be surprised. The question is, are the Russians going to assist the Iranians in defending themselves from this style of an attack? Because what you need to understand is that the Russians do benefit slightly from a managed conventional war in Iran. They don't want a nuclear war. They don't want regime change in Iran. They don't want to open up their southern flank. They don't want their potential ally in that region to be decapitated. That's not what they want. But they do want Iran to go to war with the United States and Israel in a sustained but manageable way, okay? Because it benefits them with oil price. It takes the attention off them internationally so they can continue to advance in Europe. And the only person who's not really going to be happy about this is China, but they have a lot of contingency plans as well. So guys, it looks like it's happening. And, you know, I used to think that these guys think multidimensionally about these things, and I think we just have to take it at its face. They're going to attack Iran. They're getting everything in position. Could this be an attempt to intimidate the Iranians, this forward deployment of their most sophisticated assets? It could be, but, and I would also say that what you're likely going to see is any attack that happens is going to be preceded by some sort of, you know, pager-style asymmetrical attack like we've seen in Lebanon. Remember, before Nasrallah was assassinated, there were talks of potential rapprochement between the Israelis and the Lebanese. So, you know, they want to potentially get the Iranians to lower their guard to a certain extent at the same time. So I think this two-month window that Trump has given, I would not be surprised if something happens within the next few days, possibly the next few weeks. In fact, you have Tulsi Gabbard today, who I believe, what is her position again? National Security Secretary of Intelligence, that's what she is. She came out today and deceptively, I should say, stated that they don't have any intelligence that the Iranians are getting ready to develop a nuclear bomb. Now, a lot of people would applaud Tulsi, because, of course, that's why a lot of people were supporting her, is because she was supposed to be anti-war. But when it comes to the Middle East, not so much. She's proven to be anything but. And I believe what she is doing here is making the Iranians believe that perhaps the U.S.'s intentions are not to attack them, and that this forward deployment of stealth bombers is just a maneuver and an attempt to induce readiness fatigue on the part of the Iranians, possibly try to create unrest within the country of Iran in terms of their domestic affairs, you know, rattle their economy a little bit. But I think they start doing this thing where they're giving out mixed messages and this strategic ambiguity where, on the one hand, they're saying, well, we don't think Iran's a threat. But on the other hand, every other day, they're saying that we think that Iran has the potential to be a nuclear threshold state and that they're in this state of latency and can easily, you know, switch over to being a nuclear threat. So it's very likely that we're going to see an attack come, because there never has been a better time if you're a neocon to do it. Like, you have the public support, more or less. You don't have to have the majority, right? All you need right now, the final ingredient that they need to see this thing through, is some trigger event. And it likely is just going to come in the form of something that's going to happen in the Red Sea or the Gulf of Aden, where you have the Houthis, firing on U.S. warships regularly. All it's going to take is one soldier, one death on a warship. And that could be the final thing that pushes them over the edge, because, of course, they view the Houthis as not only a proxy of the IRGC, the Iranians, but essentially one and the same thing. So they've distinctly said that we're going to hold Iran accountable for all of the offensive acts of the Houthis. The Houthis view this as defensive. And you know that they're being antagonistic here, because the Houthis basically stopped their attacks up until not too long ago. Okay, the Houthis weren't firing any missiles, in fact, when Trump entered into office. It was only after that they started to fire once again when Israel broke the ceasefire with the Gaza Strip. But even then, it was at a much lower level. So this, going in and starting a war with the Houthis, not starting one, but intensifying it, was arguably unnecessary at this point in time. Regardless, they're going to need a trigger event. So whether it's real, imagined, or fabricated, we're going to see an attack against a U.S. warship, and that'll be it. And then all of the assets will be in position, and they're going to utilize conventional or unconventional means to try to pacify the Iranians. But the Iranians are ready. And if you think that the little old Houthis can disrupt a major waterway, watch what the Iranians can do to the Strait of Hormuz with a military and capability that is probably 100 times, if not greater, that than the Houthis. Okay, so here is the more detailed technical breakdown of what's going on before we go into the bullshit ceasefire. Moscow still burning. Moscow refused to, you know, make any official statements with respect to the outcomes of the so-called bullshit peace negotiations. And I say that because that's pretty much what it is. We had a lot of other news to cover today, but I want to give you guys all the details of what's going on with respect to Iran. So here is the deets. We have a significant force of B-2s supported by C-17 cargo planes and aerial refueling tankers heading into the Indian Ocean at the island that I just specified. All within the last 48 hours, this deployment appears larger than a typical bomber task force for such a mission. Historically, it would involve fewer aircraft. They give an example here, but we don't need to do that. The presence of potentially six or seven B2s would indeed be unprecedented for Diego Garcia, representing a substantial portion of the U.S.'s Air Force fleet of a total of 20 B2s. This scale suggests more than a routine training or deterrence, and it could point towards preparations for a major operation, possibly targeting fortified sites in the Middle East. And by fortified, of course, they're talking about deep underground military bases. Past deployments, such as B-2 strikes on Houthi facilities in Yemen in October 2024, reinforced this possibility, albeit there weren't as many of these B-2s in that region. What is clear is that this concentration of stealth assets backed by logistical support signals a deliberate escalation in the capability at a key forward base. So, it's going down, and I would not be surprised at all if we've seen sparks fly in that region in the very, very near future, okay? So let's move on to what's going on in Moscow. This was, I'm not sure if it was an apartment complex or what it was, some public building in Moscow. It wasn't a military facility, but these types of fires are not rare, okay? And they're not, it's not a coincidence. This was likely an act of sabotage, as is typical. In fact, we had an oil refinery blow up in Regina, Saskatchewan, of all places, which is a know-nothing town in Canada here. And we have a big refinery there, and one of our refineries blew up. A family member was a witness to that. So that was interesting. Who knows? Maybe it was the Russians. Maybe they're pissed off at us too. Now, getting into the Ukrainian-Russian situation. Where do I even start with this? So the United States came out and they said that we're going to have a joint press conference with the Russians. That's what they initially stated after these 12-hour talks concluded. And the Russians later denied this and they said, no, we're not making any public statements with respect to this. And that pretty much tells you how these talks actually went. Here is the gist of it. Despite everything that you're hearing, what yours truly has been saying for the longest time is being vindicated through and through. And that is that these negotiations are just for the sake of temporizing and postponing the inevitable day X. No immediate comprehensive ceasefire was agreed upon throughout this 12-hour deliberation. Earlier proposals, like a 30-day full ceasefire accepted by Ukraine but rejected by Russia, were not finalized either. Discussions included a possible halt to attacks on energy infrastructure, though both sides reported ongoing strikes post-talks, indicating that there's been no immediate truce. So, there has been nothing that has been inked today. There is nothing official from this point forward that has fundamentally changed. Russia and the United States have expressed an interest in normalizing relations and continuing talks, with potential economic cooperation discussed alongside political issues. They've also proposed a framework for reinitiating the grain initiative that would basically see the demilitarization or the suspension of hostilities in the Black Sea. Again, that has not been initiated as of yet, but it is most certainly a prospect in the future. But Russia is demanding clear security guarantees before resuming the Black Sea grain deal because, of course, they don't want it to be used for what it was used for in the past, which is a smokescreen for Ukrainian rearmament and NATO ISR gathering, which, of course, empowered the Ukrainians to do more offensives. So this is why, I mean, this whole thing was operational during the peak of the crisis back in 2022 to 2023. We had the Black Sea Grain Initiative. So that shows you how far away we are from a ceasefire. When we can't even get to a point where we were, arguably, when most people thought was the peak of the conflict in late 2022, when they were having real deal DEFCON nuclear conversations, even though I would argue that the most critical time of this conflict was right before Trump got elected, and arguably As soon as the ceasefire completely fails, that's when it's going to get really, really scary. Okay, when this veneer of diplomacy between Trump and Witkoff and Putin and their delegation falls apart, that's when things are going to get scary, because that's when we enter no man's land. So long as they can keep the Russians on the line, that's really all they're trying to do at this point in time, is kick that can down the road. But Sergei Lavrov, their foreign minister, and basically the top guy next to Putin, essentially with respect to these matters, specified that the U.S. must secure a direct order from Ukrainian President Zelensky for any agreement to hold any sort of credibility. They want security guarantees. Moscow does support restarting the grain deal, but insists on modifications to eliminate ambiguities and ensure compliance. They also believe that Europe and Ukraine is just going to sabotage it the first chance they get. So, no, there is no prospect of peace in the near, medium, and I would even say long term with respect to Ukraine and Russia. In the very least, you're going to have a sustaining of hostilities at the current level of intensity while they do this migration of everybody's attention towards Iran, but that's about it. I think Trump wanted a win for the public so that he could move on to other things in the Middle East, but I don't think he's going to get even that. And this is the difference between what the White House is saying, okay, and what the Russian media is saying. So no plans to disclose any details of Riyadh talks with the U.S. And as usual, the very prudent Russians are very guarded with any sort of information when it comes to diplomacy, because they understand the stakes here, right? Sometimes if you don't have a plan, it's better to not converse with somebody at all, because it can actually backfire. And here's what the White House is saying. Outcomes of the United States and Russian export groups on the Black Sea. I think this was written by the press conference Barbie there, by the looks of things, because this is completely at odds with what the Russians are saying, okay? They're being very euphemistic in their language here, saying that they've agreed to ensure safe navigation, eliminate the use of force, and prevent, but they don't say when, right? They don't specify, and the when is the most critical part. I mean, we can agree to something, but when is it actually going to be imposed is another story altogether. And now you have Zelensky today announcing that Ukraine has now officially deployed its long-range Neptune cruise missiles capable of striking targets up to 1,000 kilometers away. So this is essentially, and they're going to be using NATO ISR and Palantir for this, so this is essentially the equivalent of like a Scalp or a Taurus missile, only much longer range, and it's going to be domestically produced. So the Russians are not going to be able to at least directly attribute it to NATO, and they're going to now start firing these. And of course, because nothing has been inked as of yet and confirmed, you know, there's a green light right now for Ukraine to continue to attrit the Russian critical infrastructure despite everything that we're hearing. And if you look at gold right now, I mean, gold is, you know, I mean, gold's telling you everything you need to know. Gold has not moved at all. You know, if Trump's reneging on these tariffs, if the tariffs were the cause of the gold price spiking, then why isn't the gold price going down with Trump saying that he's going to selectively impose less tariffs than were originally planned? At least that's not what Trump said, but that is the buzz, okay? So the gold price is nothing to do with the tariffs. Yeah, I mean, that might have, you know, had a little hand in moving the needle a little bit. But this is because World War III is coming and nations are getting ready for the U.S. dollar to be dethroned as the global reserve currency and the petrodollar, and that's all there is to it. So gold is a barometer of chaos. It has went down like $25, which is completely insignificant in the grand scheme of things, considering it's gone up 50% in the last year. So we know things are going to continue to get worse. Russia is doing its annual Yars nuclear ballistic missile training as we speak. So anything can pop off. Anything is possible. Now, this is interesting. On the day that they're supposed to be making all these advancements in peace talks, Kiev Post, which of course is the mouthpiece for Ukraine, or the current Ukrainian regime, has said that Putin might use nuclear weapons in Ukraine, according to U.S. intelligence. Russia's inability to achieve quick battlefield wins is fueling concerns that Putin could resort to nuclear weapons, according to Bloomberg, citing U.S. intelligence. So it's interesting that they decide to post this today. Now, rumor has been circulating. Aristovich, who is one of the people that many say could potentially win an election in the Ukraine. I don't know how true that is, but he is an exiled Ukrainian pundit slash politician, and I presume that he's, you know, pretty well connected. He's saying that the Ukrainian SBU chief, Budanov, had a plan or has a plan to take out Ukraine's nuclear plants and to blame it on the Russian. Now, again, guys, there's a lot of speculation and hearsay. I would say anything is on the table at this point. The linchpin of a lot of this is Iran. If that situation goes south, then, you know, anything could happen. But you got to really keep in perspective, what can they actually do in a country like Iran? Because the United States doesn't have the boots on the ground in order to go in there. I mean, they could potentially mobilize a coalition, but even that, especially when Europe is stretched thin in their dealings with the Russians, and they're just talking about, you know, struggling to put together a peacekeeping force of, what, 20,000 troops, 10,000 troops? So there's no way they're going to have the manpower. Maybe Israel can offer some assistance. So this is going to be an air campaign, and I think they have the hopes that they can do some sort of decapitation strike and install a puppet government. That's why they're talking up the Shah again, right? You're seeing him make an appearance more and more. So that's really their only option in this respect. They're going to cause a lot of chaos. Iran is going to embargo the Strait of Hormuz, and that is going to cause the price of oil to spike. Trump is going to attempt to release oil from the Strategic Oil Reserve in order to keep prices down. Will it work? I don't know. It's anybody's guess. France conducted a nuclear exercise today. They ran a large nuclear attack exercise during which pilots simulated low-altitude penetration over enemy territory followed by nuclear strikes. This was comprised of three fighter squadrons, and many tankers were airborne at the same time. And this is a map of that exercise. There was also an explosion at a Czech plant that produced shells for Ukraine. This is the only image we have of that. A powerful blast hit a factory in the Czech town of Borzina, known for manufacturing artillery shells for the Ukrainian armed forces. Now, I suppose if you expected an explosion somewhere by accident, it would be in a weapons manufacturing facility. But again, there's no coincidences at times like these. I would say that there is a 90% chance, especially if it's a military facility in Europe and something goes wrong, there likely was some cyber or direct kinetic sabotage at work. France and the UK are getting their nuclear weapons programs harmonized to fight the Russians. Okay. Now, this is the situation in the Black Sea, just to give you some perspective. Okay, so you have the Bosphorus Strait. So this is what they want. They want, you know, Ukraine to be able to ship its grain, and they want Russia to be able to get its grain through the Bosphorus Strait to ship to Africa and other places like that. The problem is, right now you have this buildup of military equipment inside Romania. Now, there's many places where they can transport equipment directly over here, over this river, but the Russians tend to bomb this region as well, and of course, that's why drones fall on Romanian soil, so I think the preferential way to do it is either by sea or otherwise. So, of course, this grain no-fly zone, whatever you want to call it, demilitarized zone, could potentially be used as a smokescreen to smuggle more weapons into Ukraine. So this is why it's not going to work. Okay, it's just not going to work. I'm not trying to be black pill. It's just a reality, and I've been right through this entire thing. I told you that there's not a hope. Snowball's chance in hell that Trump is going to be able to stop the war in 24 hours, and here we are 2 months later, and they're barely at a level of creating a framework for putting things back where Biden had it in 2022 to 2023. Okay, so forget about it. It's not going to happen. Now, I'm going to read you my analysis of this entire thing so you can try to understand how the Ukraine and Russia conflict ties into the Iranian conflict. And this is a post I made on another social media platform. And sometimes it's better when I can write these things in advance because it allows me to give you the most compendious and to the point explanation. Here's what's going to happen next. Russia stands to benefit from a managed U.S.-Israeli conflict with Iran, as it would divert international attention away from the Ukraine war and significantly increase oil prices. Economically, this would benefit Russia, provided its oil industry remains viable and intact. And that is important. However, a total collapse of Iran would ultimately harm Russian interests by exposing its southern flank, diminishing its regional influence, and disrupting weapons supplies. Because, of course, Russia presumably does get some weapons from Iran. The interplay between Ukrainian attacks on Russian oil infrastructure and Russia's potential neutrality regarding Iran might explain why Trump's administration is aggressively pushing towards confrontation. And they have this time frame that they want to get it done in. It has nothing to do with Iran being a nuclear threshold state. Nothing has changed fundamentally. They've had a similar amount of a fissile material that could be converted into a nuclear weapon for the last, you know, few years. Although now they have quantitatively more, but qualitatively it's not that much different. Notably, the two-month deadline outlined by Trump coincides closely with the objectives related to securing a Ukrainian ceasefire, and the timing of this is not coincidental. So the goal, I think, for Trump would be to have some sort of win, and Putin, to have some sort of win on that front by Patriot Day, which is May 9th. Okay, now these B-2 bombers in the Diego Garcia Air Base are slated to stay there until May 1st. But that's virtually meaningless information because, again, you're only giving out information like that, issuing an autumns like that, if there's a dual purpose to it, for the purpose of subterfuge, creating confusion with the enemy, right? So I don't think this timing is coincidental. The administration needs to act before this strategy of enabling Ukrainian attacks on Russian energy infrastructure concludes, and by concludes, I mean gets to a point where you're hurting Russia so much. Excuse me. Oh, where you're hurting Russia so much that it's no longer a viable bargaining chip. And so, in order to maintain that leverage, knowing full well that Ukraine, oh boy. I need a drink here. Talking too damn much. That Ukraine is on the warpath and that they could potentially sabotage negotiations by firing their missiles at Russian oil refineries. You have a limited amount of time before this is all going to work, right? Clearly, there is a strategic element at play with the U.S. intentionally inducing readiness fatigue in Iran through this ambiguous posturing that we're seeing. Although I don't think you would park six B-2 bombers in a region that could strike Iran if that was not your intention to do so. If the fall of Syria and Hezbollah is any indication, events could unfold swiftly and unpredictably. And as I suspected, I think we're going to see some asymmetrical style attack that precipitates all of this, okay? I don't know what that's going to look like, but it's always something tangential that comes out of left field that precedes an event like this. When Iran blocks the Strait of Hormuz, Trump will attempt to manage the economic fallout and rising oil prices by draining the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, relying on the promise of drill, baby, drill, to artificially suppress prices. Don't worry, we're going to drill. We can drain this oil reserve. It doesn't matter anymore. Unlike Biden, you know, we're not putting any restrictions on the development of our oil and gas industry. So it'll be fine. And people may believe that, they may not. We'll have to see. It depends on what the condition of the economy is in general at that point in time, because if people start spending money again, and this is why they need to cool that stock market down if they want to keep inflation down. My personal opinion is that this drill baby drill promise is not going to last long in the long term, just like the promise of a Bitcoin strategic reserve didn't send Bitcoin to 1 million and every other promise that hasn't been kept up until this point. The critical question remains, what incident will the U.S. administration use to justify striking Iran? A plausible scenario is an attack on a U.S. warship attributed to the Houthis, whom U.S. officials have already identified as Iranian proxies. So that's what it is in a nutshell. That's where we're going. The EU is saying, go down to 7-Eleven, get a few bags of chips and some toilet paper, and you should be good to go for 3 days. This whole three-day thing is silly, all right? You should have, I mean, a survival kit. Okay, a bug-out bag makes sense, but a survival kit, right? You know, you're talking about, is that stationary? Is that mobile? Yes, you should have enough food that you could throw into a backpack for 3 days in case you needed to evacuate. But 3 days, you know, if I'm in Europe right now, I'm not even in Europe, and I'm preparing for decades of unrest. If you're in Europe, depending on whereabouts you are in Europe, you want to be taking prepping really, really seriously, especially if you live in the East. And how you prepare for a situation like Ukraine, you know, can you even prepare for that? That's really one of the worst scenarios, a conventional war, to find yourself in the middle of a conventional war. You can't do anything. You can't prepare for that. You can ride it out in a bunker and hope nobody finds you down there. But, you know, good luck, right? There's no surviving that. So that's one of those oddball scenarios in which a conventional war would be actually worse than an unconventional one in terms of stationary survival. Because, you know, imagine trying to eke out an existence in a place like Kursk or, you know, one of these other frontline towns or villages that have fallen and been in the crossfire of Ukraine and Russia. It would be impossible. So, yeah, I mean, the EU is pushing citizens to prepare because they want to relieve stress on the system. They know how fragile the just-in-time delivery system is, so they're trying to do whatever they can to warm people up to this idea without inducing panic, because you don't want to do that either. So they're slowly rolling it out. Now, J.D. Vance came out today. How much time do I got left here? J.D. Vance came out and basically made some provocative statements about Greenland, saying that he's going to go and visit there because our enemies are potentially going to be using the Arctic against us. He failed to use the word Russia because, of course, that would go against the phony narrative that Russia and the United States are friends now. But make no mistake about it, they're militarizing the Arctic to go to war with Russia and China, period, point blank. I find this personally very terrifying. The fact that they're now going to be able to have access to your smartphone using satellite, and that every smartphone is about to become a satellite phone in the not-so-distant future. It's not only Starlink that's going to be doing this. There's other companies as well. It's first going to be rolled out in Europe. So no matter where you go off-grid, if you have a smartphone, they're going to be able to track your ass down. And how it works is your smartphone is going to basically link up with a satellite, and the satellite's going to send information to a ground-based satellite dish, which will then send it to a mobile network and send that message on to the person that you're talking to. All right? Gold still fluctuating around that 3020 mark. Now, this is a video that I'm not going to show you, but it's a guy, and it's going viral on, I think it's X, probably on numerous platforms. He's trying to get money out of the bank. Now, I think there's been several viral videos of this nature where a guy goes and tries to get money out of a bank, and they're grilling him about, like, what is it for, right? Like, why are you wanting to take out a few thousand dollars? Like, you have to give him an explanation, apparently. And while I can attest that this is the case everywhere you go, usually there's a limit on how much cash you can take out of the bank at any given time, okay? And there's a good reason for that. One, it's a unwritten hedge against potential bank runs because they know that the bank and just the system in general doesn't have the amount of cash to support what's on the books. So if they say there's $1 trillion worth of credits out there, there's probably only about one-tenth of that. I think it's about the cash supply is about one-tenth, if not much, much less than that. I mean, when you factor in all of the derivatives and all of the other asset and things of that nature, the cash is infinitesimally small compared to that. But in terms of just cash to money that's in the bank to actual digits on a screen, the ratio is about 10 to 1. And every bank has about 50,000 to 200,000 in cash on them at any given time. So of course, they can't, you know, just give a guy 50 grand if he goes in there and asks for it, right? But the point of all of this is that understand that when the lights go out, and they will, the ATMs are going to run out of money probably within a couple hours. However long it takes for, you know, a person to do a transaction and however, you know, many people in the lineup that ATM can serve, my guess is a few hours, those ATMs are going to be bone dry. And people say, well, you know, cash is going to be worthless in SHTF. It will be eventually if we go long enough. But in the initial phases, old habits die hard. And I would venture to say that cash is still going to be important well into any collapse scenario, even in a nuclear apocalypse. People are so trained to accept and want cash. When you wave cash in front of a person's face, even because most people aren't thinking like preppers now, they're not going to be thinking like preppers post-collapse, right? They're going to think that, oh, FEMA's coming, the government's going to make things better. So cash will still have utility in the immediate aftermath, I would say for weeks, possibly months. And I'm talking about a big event. I'm talking about full-blown mad here because people are just that naive. Now, as a prepper, you should be prioritizing things that you can actually use. But it doesn't hurt to have a little bit of cash on hand. Not a lot, because then, of course, that puts you, you know, there's a security risk of that unless you're doing survival caches and things of that nature. But just know that you're going to go to the bank one of these days. If you're fortunate enough to have some money in the bank, you're going to try to take all that money out, and they're going to patronize you. And it's going to be a shocker to a lot of people. There's a lot of so-called wealthy people right now. And this is the real crazy thing, okay? Some of the wealthiest people right now are just going to be refugees. They don't have a healthy supply of food, water, medicine, ammunition, all of the vitals. They don't have any cash because everything's credit, debit, gold card, whatever, right? Platinum card. They don't have anything, and they're living in usually the most vulnerable places in society. And when it comes down to it, maybe they have some connections. They'll be able to get some hard cash, but maybe some of them have contingency plans, but the majority of them are just going to end up as rich, poor people, rich refugees. And that's going to be something to see. Anyways, don't be that person. Keep on prepping. Thanks for watching. Don't forget to like, comment, subscribe. Canadian Prepper out.